Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Politics, money, scandal, oh yeah. Public radio's got it all, baby. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 9th of March today, and we didn't really have to go too far to find today's top story. Comes to us from right here in the world of public radio. The board of directors at NPR asked President and CEO Vivian Schiller to resign last night after a videotape of NPR's chief fundraiser disparaging the Tea Party became public. It's the latest in a series of missteps for the company and comes at a time when public broadcasting writ large, thanks in part to what's happened at NPR, is caught in a political fight. We've called Jeff Darvis for more on what's next for NPR and public broadcasting. He teaches at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. Jeff, it's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Has the board at NPR done what it clearly hopes to do now and put this political issue of funding for public broadcasting behind it with Vivian Schiller's departure?
Quite the contrary. The board, I think, has shown that they'll acquiesce to pressure and there'll be only more pressure. You know, at an NPR level, I wish NPR would give up federal financing, so we gave up this pressure. The problem is the local stations can't afford to do that.
Speaking of local stations, this is the second CEO in a row who's been dismissed by a board that you pointed out in a post this morning at Buzz Machine that is controlled by member stations.
Right, and there's a conflict inevitably coming there. The local stations have been valuable to distribute, among other things, NPR programming. Well, with the internet, with us getting radio through all kinds of things, including our phones, NPR won't need the stations as much. And the stations know that. And so a stronger NPR causes problems for the local stations. Because the local stations, there are some great ones around the country, like WNYC here in New York, that add a lot of value. But there are a lot of stations that pretty much run records in NPR programming. And as the value of distribution sinks, which it will, the value of that station sinks.
But public radio, as you know, is a small place. There are people from the company that produces Marketplace, American Public Media, who sit on NPR's board. Isn't there a way, shouldn't there be a way that they can align their interests somehow?
Can't we all get along?
That's right.
I don't know. I think that if you look at the rest of the media business, it's going through bloody upheaval. Why won't NPR as well? Because you're all nice. Sorry, that's not going to protect you from the business realities that are out there, even as a not-for-profit.
How do you explain then how NPR at the network level is doing so well? It is expanding its foreign coverage. It is expanding its domestic news coverage. It is now basically financially solid. How do you explain that in the face of these problems that we pointed out?
All these pressures on the local stations work in NPR's benefit because NPR now can have its own distribution directly to the audience around the stations. This American Life gets huge amounts of money now, or good amounts of money, from people giving directly to the show because they have a podcast.
This is one of those fraught questions that will get stations upset if NPR does it. But will the board now say, you know what, maybe you're right. Maybe federal funding isn't for public broadcasting and let's move on without it.
I don't think the NPR board will do that because the local stations depend so heavily on government money. That's the conflict in the business models here. The Associated Press is owned by newspapers who now are not the major clients of the Associated Press and who don't like where it's headed. They don't want to let the AP be the AP. Well, the real question here on the NPR board is, will the local stations let NPR be the most it can be by using the internet to its maximum? Will it let it be independent of federal funding? I don't think it will because the local stations are not in the same good position. And that means, my friends, trouble for NPR unless it can find a way to separate itself from the local stations. And that's too hard to do.
Jeff Darvis, he teaches journalism at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
On to other topics now. Healthcare reform became law a year ago this month. It's going to be a couple more years before some of its provisions take effect. But in the meanwhile, exceptions to the law are threatening to outnumber the rules for it. Insurers in the state of Maine, for instance, have just gotten the first temporary waiver from one of the key requirements of the healthcare law that insurance companies have to spend at least 80% of the revenue they get from premiums on actual medical care. And other states are lining up to get a pass as well, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Maine got the temporary waiver after Health Markets, a key insurer, threatened to leave the state if it had to comply with the rule. The rule requires insurers to spend at least 80% of premiums on care, not marketing, not administration, not profits. The waiver applies to the individual insurance market for people who aren't covered at work. Maine said that market would be destabilized if one of only three insurers pulled out. The feds agreed. Steve Larson is a deputy administrator at the Department of Health and Human Services.
There was a danger that either people could lose coverage or have to, you know, pay a lot more for the coverage they got.
Health Markets will now stay put, but insurers in other states are making the same threat. Give us a waiver or we'll leave. Deborah Cholet is a healthcare economist at Mathematica Policy Research. She says some insurers have a valid argument. Sometimes they can't spend 80% of premiums on care because overhead expenses can be higher with individual policyholders.
They do move in and out of this market, and there is administrative costs associated with enrolling and disenrolling them.
Cholet says that was a valid argument in Maine. In other states, she's not so sure. She says state insurance commissioners will have to sift through insurers' records.
They might look at compensation levels, staff and rent and other operational costs.
Maine's waiver is good until 2014. Insurers in three other states have asked for similar waivers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The recession has taught a lot of us what we can live without and what we can't live without. Air freshener, it appears, is in that second category, one specific brand of it, in fact. Procter & Gamble said today that sales of Febreze have hit the billion-dollar mark, even as other household products are struggling. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now that the housing market may stink, but when it comes to homes, they do have to pass the smell test.
No one really needs air freshener. So how did Procter & Gamble get Febreze to $1 billion in sales? It sold itself as more than an air freshener, something that killed odors lurking in sofas and curtains, stuff that's expensive to actually clean. Deborah Kay heads product innovation firm Lucule.
And then it came in as a non-aerosol. The product was the message, so they had the look of something new, and they had the smell and the cure to something new.
In all kinds of trendy scents, P&G's Lee Bansal says there are more than 2,000 Febreze products like
Hawaiian Aloha, Brazilian Carnival, New Zealand Springs.
Bert Flickinger with the Strategic Resource Group says Febreze sells especially well in Asia.
Products like Febreze smell like America. They smell clean.
And that can mask a lot of American dirtiness, from stinky sneakers to a smoking college dorm room. Literally. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street marked 2 years of a bull market today by being very cautious. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm not sure we actually need a think tank to tell us this, but state budgets are in a really bad place. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities said today 44 states and the District of Columbia are going to be in the red next year. And the center says they face daunting challenges in balancing their books. Lawmakers in Texas are struggling to close a budget gap of as much as $27 billion. And seeing how raising taxes there is about as politically appealing as a ban on barbecue means a hard look at just about everything. One proposal would eliminate four state community colleges, all four of which happen to be in rural areas without much access to higher education. Nathan Bernier from KUT reports.
So, come on in.
Ranger College Vice President Don Bostic is showing off their new nursing campus. It's located inside a mall and still has the original linoleum tile.
This is the kitchen at Kmart. This is the vent hood that was for their grill where they made the burgers. So we use it for our chemistry.
The nursing school opened a year ago, and it's already at capacity. It's one of Ranger's three campuses, and for some of the 1,600 students, it's the only college within an hour's drive. If state lawmakers have their way and close this college and other serving rural communities, whole populations might be isolated from higher ed.
I can't tell you how many non-traditional students come here. And I mean guys that have been working on the line somewhere, housewives, single moms, and they've come here to chase their dream. And without this door here that they could knock on and come through, there's no opportunity to take their shot.
But Ranger is more than a college in this part of small-town Texas.
Sometimes in his mind.
Country music is playing on the stereo when you enter Cowboy Spirits Liquor Store in Ranger. The guy who owns this business is also the mayor. And Steve Curtis is worried about the town's largest employer closing shop.
You know, basically, Ranger College is the only stimulus for the city of Ranger and the surrounding rural areas. You can just cut so much till you have nothing left.
Texas is not like other states. There's no state income tax here. The budget is already fairly lean. So now that it's time to reduce it by $27 billion, there's not a whole lot left to cut. The Republican-dominated state legislature does not want to raise taxes, and it's reluctant to dip into the state's $9 billion emergency savings account, the Rainy Day Fund. Some lawmakers say doing so would only delay tough decisions.
Well, it is really frustrating. And people drive through Ranger and see that this is a town that's kind of not what it used to be because the oil's dried up in this area.
Bill Campion is the president of Ranger Community College. Since coming on board, he's opened the nursing school, he's almost doubled enrollment, and he's working with local high schools. But that doesn't matter to state budget writers looking to cut costs anywhere they can.
This is my fifth decade of being involved in college leadership, and as I told you in the beginning, hell's going to center freeze over, then this school's going to close.
Republican House leaders have been hearing those concerns, and they say they're listening. Another spending proposal would sprinkle the cuts across community colleges rather than single out four for closure. But regardless of the outcome, community colleges threatened say the damage has already been done. It's a lot harder to convince a student to apply to your college when you can't say for sure that it'll be open in the fall. In Austin, Texas, I'm Nathan Bernier for Marketplace.
The Senate voted on another budget plan today. Two of them, actually. One from the Democrats, one from the Republicans, both with a theoretical goal of keeping the government running when the current stopgap spending bill runs out next Friday. Both, it's worth a mention, were defeated. Politicians call all the back and forth they're doing now negotiations. Commentator Robert Reich has another word.
It's called ransom. That's what Republicans are demanding from the White House and congressional Democrats for not pulling the plug on the government. The problem is, when you pay ransom once, you're almost begging to pay it again. And that's exactly the pickle the Obama administration is finding itself in. In order to avoid a shutdown last week and buy time until March 18th, the White House agreed to more spending cuts for the remainder of this fiscal year than it originally put on the table. Now, in order to get past March 18th, Republicans want even more. Democrats have offered to cut an additional $10.5 billion, but Republicans want $61 billion. The White House is hinting it will go further. Both sides want to look as if they're willing to compromise because neither side wants to be blamed by the public if a shutdown happens. And that means going halfway. They'll probably agree to split the difference, which will result in around $35 billion of additional cuts. Not in Social Security or Medicare or national defense. No, those programs are too popular for any short-term political deal. The $35 billion will come out of what's called non-defense discretionary spending for the rest of this year. This is ludicrous. Yes, fix the budget deficit when we're safely out of the gravitational pull of the Great Recession, but not now. Not with unemployment still hovering around 9% and 15 million people without jobs. Not just as the federal stimulus is coming to an end. Not at a time when state and local governments are slashing their own budgets to a total of more than $125 billion this fiscal year. Where will demand come from? Consumers can't make up the shortfall. They're still under a huge debt load. A quarter of homeowners are still underwater. Housing prices are still dropping. And with fuel prices heading toward $4 a gallon, consumers are going to have no choice but to pull in their horns. Compromising over budget cuts this year compromises the fragile recovery and puts the entire economy at risk. Democrats should never have started paying ransom. Once ransom starts, there's no end to it.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. David Frum is up in the rotation next time. Send us your comments before that, we hope. Marketplace.org. Look for the link that says contact. Coming up, when drug makers do clinical trials, speed is everything, which is why they go to Russia.
3 to 20 times faster.
But first, let's do the numbers. Muted trading today marked the second anniversary of the post-crisis bull run. The Dow Industrials just about stood still, lost a point, closed at 12,213, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ gave back 14 points, about a half percent, finished at 2751. The S&P 500 lost a point, a tenth percent, ended things at 1320. A couple of blue chips tried in vain to nudge the Dow higher. IBM notched a 2.2% gain today. That one day after it predicted it would nearly double profits by 2015. Walmart gained 1.1%. The discount retailer said it's going to start building smaller stores next week. The other big wall, that would be Walgreens, bumped up a half percent on news it's going to sell its pharmacy benefit management business. The buyer, Catalyst Health Solutions, was the day's biggest gainer, a healthy 18.5%. Bond prices rallied. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.47%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama participate in a White House conference on bullying prevention. The Treasury Department releases the federal budget for February. And the House Budget Committee holds a hearing titled, Lifting the Crushing Burden of Debt. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
I talked to Duke University economist and professor of Islamic studies Timur Karan on Friday about how Islamic law might have played into the economic problems that a lot of countries in the Middle East are dealing with. There was some agreement and some disagreement in our inbox. And there was this from Paul Wood of Panama City, Florida.
I submit that a century of anti-capitalistic colonialism followed by a century of anti-capitalistic autocracy has more to do with it than religion.
I talked to photographer J. Henry Fair about his new book last week, Aerial Shots of the Environmental Damage Done by Some Industrial Processes. That interview struck a nerve with James Nation from Roswell, Georgia. His wife, it turns out, is using tar from last year's Deepwater Horizon oil spill to make jewelry and promote awareness of the environment. About the Fair photos, Mr. Nation said this.
It's time that we start thinking and educating our children about the total cost of products we use. I enjoy my comforts and inexpensive fuel, but efforts such as these help cover the entire picture.
Finally, to my chat yesterday with Stephen Dubner about the freakonomics of Twitter, whether one is obliged to follow those who follow you. I gave Dubner what you might call a fairly hard time about his ratio of being followed, 275,000, to people he's actually following himself, which would be zero. One, actually, if you count me after yesterday's session. As tweets about that segment dribbled in after the show, I got mine, people noting that I only follow 32 people, almost as bad a ratio, they said, as Dubner's. So in the spirit of Turnabout is Fair Play, share your thoughts with us at MKT Place Radio is for the show, at Kai Rizdahl is me, or reach out to us in what has become the old-fashioned way through our website, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Over the past month or so, we've been bringing you a series of stories from Russia by our healthcare reporter Gregory Warner. And today we're going to turn to clinical trials. Pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies spend $35 billion a year testing their products in those trials. And it is not a quick process. By the time they line up participants, meet regulatory requirements, and then actually test the drugs, we're talking years. In other parts of the world, like Russia, things move more quickly. Quickly enough that the business of clinical trials there is growing 15% a year. Here's Gregory.
Getting drugs to market is basically a race against the patent clock. You want to get your drug tested, approved, and stocked on pharmacy shelves as fast as possible.
The number one reason why companies come to Russia is that they can enroll patients in Russia 3 to 20 times faster than in America or Western Europe.
David Passoff runs ClinStar. It's a company that organizes clinical trials in Russia for big drug makers. And yes, he really did say
3 to 20 times faster.
meaning a trial that starts, for example, in October and has its Russian patients ready to roll by November might only just be giving its American patients placebo pills by the following June.
In the West, people participate in clinical trials if they want to do something good for mankind, or that's their last resource.
Patients aren't paid for taking part. But in Russia, participating in a clinical trial could mean seeing that specialist that you couldn't afford, or getting diagnostic tests that you wouldn't have gotten.
They would actually get free treatment.
А вдруг я вылечусь совсем?
Галина is a 59-year-old diabetic in the northern Russian city of Yaroslavl. She already gets her insulin paid for by the state, but then her doctor offered her the chance to participate in a clinical trial.
I wanted to take part in it. There was a good chance that the insulin that they were going to give me was of a higher quality than the insulin I was currently taking. And I thought, well, maybe there's hope that I could get completely better.
She knew, at least the rational part of her knew, that you can't get completely better from diabetes. But she could still hope.
Well, I think science generally moves forward.
Much of clinical trial work is not about breaking new scientific ground. It's usually seeking new uses for old brands or new brands to compete with drugs that already do a pretty good job. And in America, this kind of research is increasingly done not by top specialists, but by doctors looking for extra cash. Not so in Russia.
Our investigators in clinical trials tend to be more prominent physicians because they get to be on the cutting edge of medicine.
Doctors like Andrei Koronov. He's the one that brought Galina into that clinical trial. He's also tested drugs in cardiology, pulmonology, dermatology, gastroenterology, post-surgery drugs, anemia, and endocrinology. Koronov tells me that he does this research both for the cash and for professional pride. Out here in Yaroslavl's municipal hospital, far from the research centers of Moscow,
doctors here don't often get to work with novel drugs. Now we get to learn about these drugs before they get on the market, and we can let the doctors around us know about which way the science is heading.
And when Koronov talks about a drug to other doctors, it's not just with one or two colleagues in the break room. As a clinical pharmacologist in one of the city's largest hospitals, he gives the lectures to other doctors about which drugs they should use and when.
Companies are naturally interested that we know about their drugs so that we can give presentations to other doctors about those drugs.
This is where the clinical trial industry becomes as much about marketing drugs as about testing them. Drug companies even have a code name for these influential doctors in foreign countries.
If we are speaking about opinion leaders.
We are speaking about opinion leaders. This, by the way, is Tatiana.
Tatiana Balashova.
A Russian biochemist who, in the late 1990s, was plucked from her job as a poorly paid university professor and hired as a sales rep for the drug maker Sanofi Aventis, then called Sanofi.
Because I like Sanofi very much.
Balshova tells me that she owes her professional esteem to that company because it gave her what the Russian economy could not, a good salary, interesting work, and the respect of her scientific education. For years, her job as a drug rep was to find ways to make influential doctors feel about that company like she did.
We have a different budget for opinion leaders. His birthday, for example. When a very important specialist had his birthday,
drug companies would show up to pay their respects. They'd form a line in the morning, she said, so that by supper time they could come up and say happy birthday and hand them a present. Sometimes the receiving line was longer.
It depends on the level of the doctor.
Those birthday parties are more muted now. Russia has passed laws, similar to those in the States, limiting the kind of gifts the drug reps can offer. And the U.S. Department of Justice is investigating several major drug firms for their financial ties to Russian physicians. But Tatiana Balashova is still in the business of courting doctors, not with swag, but with science. She no longer works as a drug rep. She now works for ClinStar, organizing clinical trials across the country. And she knows that every time they line up another doctor to test out a new drug, they snag a potential spokesman.
It's obviously because they were involved in clinical trials, and now when this drug is registered in Russia, they like to use it.
And hopefully recommend it to hundreds of their doctor friends. In Russia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
You can check out a map of the spread of the Russian clinical trial business and hear the rest of our series online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which rising commodity prices literally hit us in the collective wallet. You might have heard that cotton prices are up, which means clothing is more expensive, of course. But so, it turns out, is money. Actual dollar bills. Paper money, it turns out, isn't really paper, but a blend of 75% cotton, 25% linen. The Bureau of Engraving and Printing says higher cotton prices mean the bills it produced last year, regardless of face value, cost almost 10 cents to make. That's double the cost just a couple of years ago. Seeing as how the government prints 6.4 billion banknotes every year, better believe it adds up. And that is Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow edged down a point, closed essentially flat. The Nasdaq gave back 14 points, about a half percent. The S&P 500 lost a point, one-tenth of 1% on that particular index. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back on the big broadcast, no job, baby on the way, and then the recession hits.
It was like suddenly we were standing there and there was nothing to do. We did not know what to do. There was no work we could do. We want to work.
A personal story of economic survival. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.